welcome to another episode of The Two Brandons. This is Brandon Easton, and I'd like to say today we have an incredible guest, and I'm going to let my colleague Brandon Thomas tell you a little bit more about that.
Yeah, how you doing, everybody? Today we have a very special guest, a man that I have known for several years now, Mr. Joseph P. Illich, formerly of Milestone, formerly of DC Comics, formerly of RK Entertainment, which is where we first connected. He was a very, very important part of getting my Many Adventures of Miranda Mercury book at Arkea. And we thought that given what's going on in the industry in the past couple of weeks in regards to editing comics, conflict between editorial and creative, as long as in addition to some other things like the recent John Stewart dies / lives news and the recent announcement of who is going to be taking over Quantum and Woody for the new Valiant Comics, we decided that this would be a perfect opportunity to bring him in and pick his brain and get his perspective on some of these and other topics. So I'll kick it to him.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on the show. Just talk to everyone. My name is Joseph Philip Illich. I started my comic book editing career at Milestone Media, which was the first mainstream black-owned comic book company that had a publishing deal with DC Comics. Milestone was founded by five black men, Derek Dingle, the dear departed Dwayne McDuffie, who was one of my mentors, who was the editor-in-chief of Milestone, Dennis Cowan, Michael Davis, and as history would later reveal, Christopher Priest. Christopher Priest was one of, I think, the first black writers in mainstream comics, and among many of the things he created or co-created is Quantum and Woody, which is something that we will be talking about later. And from Milestone, I went over to DC Comics, where I was an editor on the Batman line of comics. And then after that, I took some time away from comic books, and I stayed in publishing and dealt with manufacturing and learned about the value of the book after you have the content, because you can have the best content, but if the packaging is terrible, it diminishes the entire product. So I learned a lot about book manufacturing and presentation. I got back into comic book editing with Arkea, and as Brandon pointed out, it was at Arkea that I worked with him, and I felt like my mission there, as my mission always is to increase the diversity in comics, not only behind the scenes, but with the characters. So Miranda Mercury was something that I considered very important. And when the time came that I had the opportunity to help Brandon and his co-creator Lee Ferguson bring her into the light, I was honored to do it. And since then, I have co-founded a production company, Verge Entertainment. One of my partners is Sean Martinbrough. Sean Martinbrough is the artist on Image's Thief of Thieves comic book, which is done by Robert Kirkman's division Skybound Entertainment. I think it is Skybound's number two selling comic in back of, say it with me people, The Walking Dead. And I am now co-writing with Sean a graphic novel for First Second called The Wren, which takes place during the Harlem Renaissance. And it is all about a love story and a crime story during the celebration of the culmination of artists and writers and musicians and dancers, this rich culmination of black talent in American history, something that has not really been discussed a lot and, to my knowledge, has never been profiled in a graphic novel. So we're going to be honored to, I think, be the first to do it. It will be coming out by First Second Books in 2015. And other than that, I do various freelance writing and editing projects for mainstream clients outside of the regular comic book circuit.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. Well, the first thing we want to talk about this week is, I'm sure everyone knows, we've had a couple of recent high-profile I'm trying to think of the best word.
Departures?
High profile departures. Yes, that sounds, that's kind of nice. High yeah. profile departures from high profile DC Comics projects. First and foremost, Andy Diggle, co-creator of The Losers. He's writing the upcoming arc of Thief of Thieves. A very, very well-known, well-respected creator with an obvious pedigree was scheduled to take over Action Comics from Grant Morrison. And recently he has decided that it is not for him. And I believe the same day, or possibly the next morning, there was also a writer, I might butcher his last name, Joshua Hill Fialkoff, who was going to take over, I believe, Green Lantern Corps and Red Lanterns. And he also decided that he was going to take a walk and abandon his DC projects. And that was one of the things that, that got us talking internally about editorial, about disagreements between editorial and creatives. How do you resolve problems? How do you diffuse conflict? And since Joe has a very interesting storied history as an editor at several different companies, we thought he'd be the perfect person to come in and talk a little bit more about the art of editing comic books.
Well, okay. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the opportunity to do that because I think what really compels me to talk about it now is, you know, you have Twitter, you have Facebook, you have comic book resources and all these websites, and what you see in response to this type of news is a lot of bile coming from fans, and they're blaming the editors, and they don't understand how business works. Mm. Not how comics work, but how business works. Because the thing of it is, okay, now, it's true that an editor to some degree is responsible for the vision of his or her book. Now, there's a shared universe agenda, a continuity that has to be maintained. But the editor usually, or at least when I used to edit comic books, had some basic responsibility and had some contribution to the direction of their book. And when I was a Batman editor, especially, I remember once a year, Paul Levitz, who at the time was the president and publisher of DC Comics, he would have meetings with all of the editors. And he would say, okay, tell me what your one-year plan is for Birds of Prey. And I would have to talk with him about it. I would say, okay, this is what I see happening for the characters. Just really basic beats. Like, you're not coming up with the stories, because that's the job of the writer. But there are certain beats of evolution that you want certain characters to go through, and you discuss them with him, and he talks with you about whether that speaks to the integrity of the characters, whether that speaks to the integrity of the DC universe, things of that nature. Now, that was before Warner Brothers became heavily involved in DC Comics, and that was before Marvel was bought by Disney, and that was before Christopher Nolan made billions of dollars through Batman for Warner Brothers, and Avengers made $1 billion for Disney. And so now what you have is you have a level of corporate involvement in the comic books that is unprecedented. Because before there was some kind of separation, but now it's very clear that the value of the characters, the value of the intellectual properties, to some degree you can't even call them characters because characters evolve and age through four-dimensional time, but these characters really don't, because they have to be on bedsheets, they have to be toys, they have to be cartoons. So there's an illusion of evolution, but not really so. So the corporate involvement basically dictates the editorial agenda. Because what happens is, and Marvel is brilliant at this, and you can see the through lines when a movie of one of their characters is coming out, things that are happening in the comic books are lining up to parallel with that Marvel movie continuity, so that when people go to buy the source material, what they're seeing aesthetically and in terms of archetypes is pretty familiar with what they're seeing in the movies. It's not the same continuity, but for example, Iron Man 3 is coming out. Iron Man 3 has elements from the Warren Ellis Iron Man story, Extremis, which has a character named Maya Hansen. So, of course, in the Marvel Now relaunch of Iron Man, who is there? Maya Hansen, right?
Yep.
That's no accident. Things are going to dovetail and parallel to some degree what's happening in the film. So with these kind of bigger licensing concerns, there's a different kind of agenda happening with the characters and happening with the universe versus, and corporate involvement is definitely a factor in that. So the editors now do not have as much control as they did before. And speaking for myself, for example, I told you about when I would discuss with Paul Levitz what I was planning to do with the year of Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to pick a new artist for Birds of Prey. I was able to pick a new illustrator. I was able to pick a new colorist. My guess, I'm not speaking with any kind of authority because I'm not working at DC now. My guess is the editors are not choosing their talent.
My guess
is that each company has a pool of talent, and that pool of talent are people that they value for a variety of reasons, one of which is their ability to sell a certain amount of copies of books. That talent gets revolved throughout the entire universe, placed here, placed here, placed there. So what I believe is happening is that editors are told, this is your team for that book. Make sure that book comes out on time every month and maintains a certain standard of quality, and that what you are doing in that book works with our overall plans for our universe. That is how I think it goes. I think editors of certain levels of authority can make that kind of contribution. Obviously, like a Steve Wacker at Marvel.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Tom Brevoort.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, an Eddie Braganza. So, at DC Comics, or a Matt Idelson. So, at certain levels in the hierarchy, those contributions can be made, ideas of who the talent are. But in the bottom levels, absolutely not. I cannot see that. That doesn't make sense, because there's too much at stake for someone to just come out of the blue and say, oh, I want this person to write this book. Because naturally you would ask them, well, based on what? Based on what do you want this person to write the book? When you think about the kind of profit that one would expect from an X title versus the kind of profit you may expect from Daredevil, and then thinking about the DC Universe, the kind of profit you would expect from Justice League of America versus the kind of profit you would expect from Birds of Prey, those things dictate the talent that's going to go on those books. So, again, what this really speaks to is that the controlling forces, the major controlling forces that create the comic books that fans buy every week, is not the editors. And I feel like the editorial community has taken a bad rap because of it. And to some degree, I wanted to illuminate people about the serious relationship between the business and the content, and how the business factors are becoming more and more significant every day. And
right.
So, I mean, there have been problems going on for some time. The Andy Diggle, Joshua Hale Fialkov double departure in 2 days, that's just amazing. And that is something that has been in the wake of earlier things. Rob Liefeld going off on Brian Cunningham on Twitter.
Mm.
DC
Gail
editors.
Simone.
Yeah, the Gail Simone firing and return in 2 weeks. And some of these things will always be mysteries. We will never know the true stories behind them, and nor should we. And that's another thing. Fans are under the misconception that they should know everything. No one should know everything. Some things should remain private. But the fact of the matter is, comic books have finally caught up to corporate America in terms of being run like a business. Marvel and DC have finally caught up to Tropicana orange juice. They finally caught up to Levi's jeans. They finally caught up to Sony in terms of what forces influence the product. And the editors, to some degree, are more traffickers than visionary supervisors.
So, I mean, do you think that that's part of the reason that we seem to be witnessing a lot of conflict between writers and their editors, because the editors aren't the people that are actually picking the writers that they're allowed to work with? Do we think that, you know, is contributing to some of the issues they've been having? Because, you know, if you believe the internet, and obviously it's always a dicey proposition, it seems that storylines are being approved and then changed at the last minute. There's constant rewriting and redrawing, and obviously that's something that creative professionals aren't being compensated for. You know, you don't get paid to rewrite a script 3 or 4 times, and it sounds like that's some of the things that are occurring. So do you think that that's part of the issue, that editors are not being allowed to pick exactly who it is they want to work with?
I don't think that's it. I mean, one of the jobs of an editor is to be able to work with people in general. You should be a people person, and no matter what team is given to you, you introduce yourself, you talk with them, and you work with them, and you make a good product. But what I think is that the editors are vehicles for policies which are given to them by higher powers. And just like in any business, you may have philosophical differences with orders given to you, but you have to carry them out. You have to execute them. And you have to tell your talent the bad news. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And you have to make sure that no matter what, Action Comics comes out every 30 days. Astonishing X-Men comes out every 30 days. Batwing comes out every 30 days. These things must happen because it's business. So the editors, in some cases, are vehicles for policies that they don't originate. And they cannot tell the talent their opinions. They have to get the job done. And creative people, understandably, are not going to like all of the decisions. And, I mean, Andy Diggle reportedly said that his workload was growing and he had to make a decision. And we see that he's doing work for a lot of different companies. And what we notice is that the difference between what he's doing for, say, Dynamite and what he's doing for Image versus what he was doing for DC Comics is, with the other things, he's working on newer characters, maybe some of which he's creating, and so it allows him more flexibility to help nurture a world. Mm-hmm. But when you are dealing with Superman, make no mistake, you are not in charge at all. You are basically the best hammer out of the toolbox right now. Mm-hmm. I need a good hammer so I can hit a nail with it. Okay? That's the hammer is right now Andy Diggle. I need a good wrench so I can turn this thing. Okay, maybe that wrench is Tony Daniel. You know, you're a contractor. You get paid to do a job. And the sanctity of Superman, it far outweighs you. Mm-hmm. It far outweighs you from a corporate context, certainly from a shareholder context.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I have a question for you, Joe.
Sure.
One of the things, you know, I've been, you know, talking about my own career, and I've talked about this, is I believe that any working adult professional should have a level of transparency, in the sense that if you're in a corporate environment, and, you know, there's corporate memos and there's meetings, you know, every 30 seconds, basically. You know, the question I always have is, like, why don't people talk about this in a straightforward manner in order to, let's just keep it, you know, keep it as real as possible, like to, you know, settle beasts before they occur? Like, why can't creative professionals, you know, sit down and explain, okay, this is exactly what the problem is? I mean, do the people they hire not know that the corporate influence is a major factor, or is something else happening behind the scenes?
I think what happens is it's a situation where you don't know until you get there. It's the same way that, you know, when Barack Obama first ran for president, he had all these plans, and right. He makes it, and you get to the Oval Office, and you start meeting all these people who really tell you which way the wind blows. And suddenly, all these platitudes you had of dreams get altered and given a new context of reality. And I think that what happens is creators are given offers to work on characters that are globally known, and that naturally excites them, and they want to dig their heels in and their fingers in, and they want to tell some great stories. They want to create definitive volumes in the history of the character. And what happens is then they start getting hit with the reality of it. And you really don't know what it's like until you experience it for yourself. And that's the way it is with any job. That's the way it is with any experience in life. Someone can tell you what it's like to get your heart broken,
right,
but it's
right.
Nothing like the feeling. The feeling.
Right.
You know what you'll say? This is what you'll naturally say. You'll say, okay, man, I'm sorry about what happened to you. That won't happen to me.
Right.
That
right.
will be your natural inclination. That won't happen to me. And sure enough, it does. And that's how you learn. So creators dealing with mainstream companies are going through some disillusionment right now, I think, or some serious disappointment. But also what we're seeing is, I think, an unprecedented amount of creator-owned projects and so many different vehicles through which to distribute your stories, so that if you don't want to deal with one of the big two, and you may have enough of an equity value in the independent scene, you can just do your own characters, and you can release them in the digital format like Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin just did with The Private Eye.
This is great, by the way.
Yeah, or you can, you know, do what Ed Brubaker did, where he basically apparently walked away from, you know, his number one client altogether, and, you know, Fatal is out, and Fatal is a really amazing piece of work. So I think that the combination of what's happening with the big companies and the opportunities for creator-owned vision and different modes of distribution, I think those things come together, and I think a lot of creators are finding the option to do their own ideas a lot more appealing. And let's not forget the crowd sourcing, the crowdfunding element. You know, Jamal Igle is now able to do Molly Danger because of Kickstarter and because he hung in there. I donated twice. I donated, and then the last 8 days, I remember, was coming down to the wire, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to donate again, because Jamal cannot lose. Because if he wins, he becomes a symbol for what is possible. And if he loses, it'll just be a damn shame. And I didn't want him to lose. And I'm glad he won. And I'm glad Molly Danger will come to light.
Yeah, that's going to be a tremendous project. But, I mean, I was watching it like you were, especially at the end, because I think when he was about a week out, he was still not too far away from the margin, but still a ways away. And I'm like, oh, no, like, yeah. It's not going to make it, and it's going to turn into a thing. And that's something else we'll talk about, how, you know, because there are so few minority creators working in and around comics, everything that one of us does becomes even more, the importance of it becomes overinflated. And
right,
people want to take one situation and kind of, you know, spread it all around. So you know, like a lot of us, not to say that other people didn't have a personal interest in Molly Danger and making sure that Kickstarter hit its goal. You know, I know, you know, personally that it's like, oh, we got to get Molly Danger. If we can't get that, then, you know, we're sunk, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, no other black creator is going to be able to put out a Kickstarter for at least a year, you know, if this doesn't happen. So I was very glad that it did. I was very glad to participate. And, you know, I can't wait to see the book. Can't wait to see it.
Same here, man.
But, I mean, along those lines, while we're talking about that specifically, one of the situations that has kind of been highlighted is a reason or a rationale why Joshua Falkoff walked away from his two Green Lantern titles was DC Comics decided that Jon Stewart was going to become a casualty to... obviously, for a sales bump to try to spike interest in their new wave of Green Lantern creative teams that will be taking over the book after Geoff Johns leaves. Now, I don't know if everybody knows, but word broke that was one of the critical reasons that led to Joshua walking off the books. And I think before the day was even over, reports emerged that DC had completely backed off of that, and they have big plans for Jon Stewart going forward, and all is well in the world. Except... The question has to be asked, you know, why was it Jon Stewart? You know, I think that...
You well, come on, man. There are 3,600 Green Lanterns. You mean the black guy getting killed? You see a problem with those averages? One out of 3,600?
Well, look, I'm going to tell you how it looks to me. How it looks to me is that DC Comics, just like you said, even if it's the comic side or it's the Hollywood side, I think that they have a vested interest in trying to make sure that Hal Jordan is the number one, you know, accepted, embraced Green Lantern for all of these, you know, projects that they would like to appear in, you know, Justice League movies, further cartoons. I think that DC Comics would prefer for Hal Jordan to be the Green Lantern that everyone considers to be Green Lantern. The problem with that is a very well-received, beloved Justice League cartoon where Jon Stewart was the Green Lantern. And so there are all these people out here that think that Jon Stewart is Green Lantern. They don't even know who Hal Jordan is. On top of that, Justice League and a host of other, you know, DC Warner Brothers cartoons are about to go up onto Netflix on March 30th. So now this whole idea that Jon Stewart is the Green Lantern is going to be, you know, it's going to be dispersed into the marketplace even further. And I just think it's suspicious that after DC Comics introduces another brown-skinned Green Lantern with a gun and a mask, that all of a sudden, you know, Jon Stewart has to go.
Right. Well, one of the things I had noticed was I think that there's this massive, massive disconnect on some level between the powers that be in these corporate agencies and the actual fan base. I mean, we've seen it with the cancellation of the Green Lantern animated series as well as Young Justice. And now Warner Brothers Animation is reporting that they were somehow shocked or amazed that there would be that type of outcry when you cancel the only series that are actually dealing with superheroes in a serious way. You know what I mean? And I think also they've underestimated the impact of at least one generation of young kids who did grow up with Jon Stewart as Green Lantern.
That's right.
And you're absolutely right, Brandon. And, you know, Joe, everything you're saying is absolutely hitting the spot, and you're right on point. I don't want to sit and think it was just a racial decision, you know, because there's a part of me that wants to give people the benefit of the doubt. But I've always felt that there's been a immense undervaluing of African Americans, specifically African American characters in mainstream comics. And we've seen it a million times. We've discussed it a million times. And the fact that they were so willing to sacrifice Jon Stewart and then just as quickly reverse their decision, it says a lot about the intestinal fortitude or lack thereof of the powers that be. You know, if you're going to make that decision, I mean, stick with it. Don't change it suddenly because people are complaining. You know, you should stick with it. So I kind of question a lot of things that are going on behind the scenes. I mean, and this is me making a statement in partial ignorance, but just the way that went down offended so many people. I mean, I wasn't even aware it happened because all this stuff happened within 72 hours.
Yes.
You know, I was busy, you know, doing things, and then I look up, and then you're like, and Brandon Thomas is raging about and I'm like, what did I miss now? You know, because it seems like once a week the comic book industry is doing something egregious. You know what I mean? Like every time I turn around, there's something else stupid happening at mainstream comic book company. So, I mean, I'm somewhat ignorant because I'm just busy, and I'm also ignorant because I don't want to get angry. Because when I start to do the research and I start to pay attention, I'll get angry again. And right. I'm just trying to look at it from the perspective of someone who has enjoyed Green Lantern in all his various versions. I mean, I like Hal. I like the crazy Kyle. One. What's the crazy dude with the redhead? Guy Gardner. You know, I remember. You know, I remember the book that Bart Sears used to draw and J.M. DeMatteis and those other guys used to write back in the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, I really enjoyed and, you know, it was incredible stuff. And they had Guy Gardner. And then, you know, Hal Jordan goes insane. And then Crabface, you know, Kyle Rayner comes, you know, and that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, they had the brother Jon Stewart on the animated series because, you know, from what I understood, Warner Brothers Animation, you know, pretty much made them diversify the team or else the show would have probably started with an all-white superhero team. Mm-hmm. But they made them put Hawk Woman, who was amazing character, who I know nothing about before the animated series, and then, of course, Jon Stewart, who I did know about. But every time I saw him, I'd always, in my imagination, from some writers, saw him portrayed as Luke Cage with a Green Lantern ring. You know what I mean?
Right,
and
right.
For a while, I was like, I don't want to see him because he's going to have an afro and he's going to talk in broken English. But, you know, brother Dwayne McDuffie and the other producers made sure that he was an upstanding military guy. And I thought that was one of the best decisions that was made for that Justice League series. You know, and that's just my take on things. I just feel that, you know, sometimes I don't think they realize what they actually have in their hands. I think they kind of don't take certain things seriously or give it the weight it deserves. And then they kind of look off in this either prefabricated shock or they're legitimately shocked that people care. And that's what freaks my mind.
Right. Yeah. That they thought that they could kill Jon Stewart and nobody would say anything about it.
Right. You know, I mean, it's like, come on. It's like, come on.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, going backwards along the trajectory that you laid out in terms of the Justice League cartoon, which became Justice League Unlimited, and Dwayne's influence as the story editor and one of the major writers. Obviously, it was important to him to have proper portrayal of characters of color, to have proper portrayal of women. And it's interesting how the Justice League cartoon was able to do more groundbreaking things. I mean, not only establishing Jon Stewart as the Green Lantern, but an interracial relationship,
yep,
and an interracial kiss.
Yeah, good
that,
point.
That, yeah. Yeah, you know, that these things could happen in a venue that reaches more people than a comic book.
A lot
but
more
it,
people.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so hard or those same things that happen in a comic book. I always find that an interesting kind of dichotomy. And in terms of a whole generation of people growing up with Jon Stewart as a Green Lantern, that's a fact. And I honestly don't believe that the people in power are unaware of this. I believe they don't care. And I do subscribe to Brandon's theory about the idea of having the vision of the intellectual property of the Green Lantern as a white male, as Hal Jordan specifically, and thinking that anything else would confuse the issue from a licensing standpoint. And I think part of the reason why they were just willing to kill Jon Stewart, and this goes to something serious now, is that fans don't punish companies for doing things they don't like.
Mm.
Because let me tell you what would have happened. First of all, we don't even know with Jon Stewart. We're hearing he's dead, he's going to come back, or he's not going to die, whatever. We really don't know. They could still surprise us. But if Jon Stewart dies, how many black consumers of DC Comics would stop buying DC Comics?
I think 1% would.
Okay.
Yeah, so me and someone else.
There you go. And the other 99% will complain to their friends, will complain online, will say it's a damn shame, and then the following Wednesday, they will go back and they will purchase some more books. And 1 month later, they might even purchase Green Lantern. Right? So, because fans don't punish companies for doing things they don't like, why should the powers that be feel like there's any problem with killing off Jon Stewart, right?
There's no consequence.
Exactly. And the consequence that is cared about is money. The use, the delivery and the withholding of money. is the consequence or reward, right? So if, let's say, you know, let's go in some fantasy world. Let's say for 1 month, every black consumer of DC Comics in the aftermath of the death of Jon Stewart did not buy any DC Comics. None. What would happen to those numbers across the board? Then we have to ask ourselves why. Then we have to trace it to when did this begin? Oh, this began here. What happened during this time before the dip occurred? Oh, they're serious. And then your thinking changes. But we know that fans allow themselves to be kicked, beaten, humiliated, dismissed, and come right back with the cash.
You know, on the first episode, I actually said that the comic book industry, like professional wrestling, is the only industry I'm aware of where people will still give you money in the hopes it gets better, in the hope that it gets better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've never seen it. It's like a weird Stockholm syndrome of consumerism. You know, it's like people identify with their, you know, provider or hostage so much that they don't see themselves. No, I'm serious. They don't – like, I'm telling you, like, there were things – like, I'll give you an example. Like, when Vertigo back in the late 90s and early 2000s had their so-called, you know, creative renaissance with Preacher and Hellblazer and all that stuff, Brian Azzarello and Garth Ennis loved to put the word nigger in almost every book they wrote. So no matter what, I don't know these guys personally, but I stopped buying Preacher and Hellblazer and anything that those two guys wrote for a little while because I was so offended that they decided to go to the Quentin Tarantino school of black dialogue, you know? And I was one of those people. It took me a very long time to get to the point where I was willing to walk away because comics was such a part of my identity and a part of my cultural legacy as a person, you know, that it's very difficult to call those things into question. It's sort of like when we have a rapper who clearly uses foul language, you know, denigrates women, denigrates the community, but there'll be those people out there who will still defend them and buy their work. Like, you know, Chris Brown beat Rihanna to a pulp, but there are still young ladies out there.
A lot of young ladies.
Who will defend Chris Brown and say things like, well, he didn't beat me. Or, that's Rihanna's fault for going back to him. And so forth and so on. And I kind of think that black comic book buyers are the worst of this kind. Because I just put on my Facebook 2 days ago yesterday actually. I've quit a lot of Facebook groups that are dealing with blacks and comic books. Because 90% of the people whine and complain endlessly about Marvel in DC, but every Wednesday they're dropping $50 to $100 on Marvel and DC comics while ignoring all the independent folks out there. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of a thing where you're right. If all the black folks who buy comics and they don't like what these companies are doing just made it known, like have a blackout month on Twitter or on Facebook and say, we're not buying any comics, period. Or 2 months or 3 months or a 6 month span to where you could see a noticeable drop. Maybe things would change, but if you're going to whine and then still buy Green Lantern, even if they kill Jon Stewart, black folk would buy that issue.
Buy that issue. That's right. Buy that issue, and then the one after it, and then the one after
one after it.
Because what they have to do is they now have to bitch with authority about the about the book in the aftermath of the absence of Jon Stewart, right? And you know. What you're talking about with the consumerism and the addiction, it's serious. I mean, I think fans don't even realize if you disconnect yourself from something long enough, you realize that your life is not really diminished without it. It's like being addicted to French fries. Mm. It's like being addicted to a television show that, like you said, you're hoping gets better, but every week it doesn't get better. You know, if you just stop watching that for 4 episodes, you're like, hey, this is all right. You know, I'm still right here. So, I mean, what's happened to me, and this is not the result of any boycott, I think this is just my personal growth and my strong desire to support independent creators. I noticed one day that I hardly buy Marvel or DC Comics without intent. That was not a plan. That just turned out to be the aftermath. And I'm proud to give my money to creators working on their own projects and independent companies that want to make an impact. I love what Image Comics is doing. And, I mean, if there is a mainstream company that I may actually like, and the jury's still out, but I'm kind of getting seduced, is Valiant. Mm. I really like Harbinger. I really like how it's written. It's written by Joshua Dysart. Joshua Dysart did an amazing Vertigo Vertigo series called Unknown Soldier.
Yep.
And I wasn't buying Unknown Soldier when it came out in single issues. And then Unknown Soldier got canceled. And I realized that I was part of the reason why. If you just keep waiting for the trades, if you don't buy this thing every month, if you don't support it, if you don't give it momentum, you can't expect it to have long life. And that realization with Unknown Soldier turned me around and said, okay, you know what? I can't wait for the trade anymore. So if there's something out there by an independent creator and I believe in it, unless it's some ridiculous amount of money, I'm going to buy it. I'm going to buy it and I'm going to back it. And that's the only way things change. Things change from a redirection of consumer monies. Mm. And that's the importance. That's the power that fans have. But they don't realize it. They don't realize their power to affect these companies through which they have strong relationships.
Yep. And I'm glad you brought up Valiant, because that'll bring us to our probably final topic of the week. Quantum and Woody, beloved cult series from, what was it, the late 90s? I can't even remember when it was from.
Yeah, I think it was like the mid to late 90s.
Mid to late 90s,
yeah. Created by Christopher Priest, fantastic writer. Everyone knows him. Black Panther run. I had custom hardcovers made out of it. I love it so much.
And, excellent choice.
And M.D. Bright. And for years, this was one of those series that everyone had very fond memories of, fans, other creators, And I believe it was published by Acclaim Comics, which was not quite a... It was kind of part Valiant, but not Valiant. And...
Acclaim owned Valiant.
Okay. So they absorbed... They bought and absorbed Valiant.
Exactly.
And I believe this Quantum and Woody was one of the original projects that was created for Acclaim Comics. And Valiant has just made the announcement that Quantum and Woody is coming back. Everybody got really, really excited about it. And then they announced the creative team, which, you know, mind you, before we start, I like the writer. I have his work on my shelf. I think he's a really talented up-and-comer. He's writing Gambit now. He wrote the second arc of Thief of Thieves. But I don't think a lot of people expected him to be the new Quantum and Woody writer. I think that I had the expectation that Christopher Priest would have been the first person to have been approached. And as far as we know, that could be the case. But based on the way the announcement was made, there seemed to be very little mention of Priest or M.D. Bright and their input into this new series in regards to even being allowed to pitch for it, knowing that it was going to come out. So there are still a lot of unanswered questions concerning that. But I know a lot of people were really, you know, really disappointed and heartbroken to see that someone else is going to continue the new adventures of these beloved characters that were created by two black men. So,
yep. Yeah, Mr. Easton, do you want to speak to this first?
Well, I've met the guys who create, the new owners of Valiant, they seem like they had their heart in the right place. I guess my only thing is I don't want to say too much about it because I don't know what the mechanics of the development was. You know what I mean? I don't know who they reached out to. I don't know who they wanted to hire. I don't know if the current team was a second choice. I will say that it is kind of disheartening to see that not even Doc Bright or M.D. Bright, you know, I used to call him Doc Bright, not even Doc Bright is involved, and I don't know what he's up to these days, but it's not a pleasant feeling to see something like that, you know, and that's as far as I'm going to go with it until I find out more information, but I would have liked to have seen at least a mention of or some kind of acknowledgement given to the original team.
Yeah, my take on it is, well, number one, I'm not going to be buying that book. And that's the ultimate statement. The ultimate statement is the delivery or the withholding of cash.
There you go.
So I will not be purchasing Quantum and Woody. I buy Harbinger, but I'm not buying Quantum and Woody. One of the things about Quantum and Woody that was so great, and this speaks to what made Dwayne McDuffie's work so great, what made a lot of other work by Christopher Priest great, Zero, his run on Steel, his run on a short-lived Marvel series called The Crew, and of course, as Brandon mentioned, his seminal run on Black Panther, which as far as I'm concerned is the definitive Black Panther, alongside the Don McGregor of Black Panther, is that there was a level of verisimilitude with the characters because when creators of color write characters that reflect their backgrounds, there's a shared experience. They will understand things that someone from a different background could not understand. And just, I remember reading Christopher Priest's run on Steel, and he does this scene where, you know, John Henry Irons is this well-known doctor and inventor, and he saved the world with the Justice League 100 times, but he can't catch a cab in New York.
Right.
And it's just so great. Like, that moment is so telling that you can try to save the world 100 times, but to the New York cab driver in the 90s, you're just a black man. And I'm going to drive past you, and I'm going to pick up a white person with money. And so he brought that same level of character truth to the character of Eric, who's the guy under the quantum uniform. And that is something that I dare say James Asmus cannot do, and James Asmus cannot do it to the same level of truth that Christopher Priest can do it. So from the standpoint of a writer and a lover of good writing and a lover of Christopher Priest's work and Quantum and Woody, philosophically, that's my problem with Quantum and Woody. Now, on the business side, and this goes back to what we were saying before, James Asmus is a known quantity. He has written Generation Hope, I think it was called, for Marvel Comics, which, you know, spun out of the whole X-Men, I think, Messiah Complex. He's finishing up a run on Thief of Thieves, which is, I think, Robert Kirkman's number two selling comic book.
Yes.
He's a known quantity to the fans. So when you transfer that over to Quantum and Woody, and then you add the fact that he's a comedian by profession, and Quantum and Woody has inherent an element of comedy, you can see the business decision behind hiring him to write the book. Now, I could argue that there are black comedians that could have been considered. I could argue that novelist Stephen Barnes, who is an amazing writer, and Steve and I are friends, and he can be funny. He could have done it. And he could have written a good Quantum and Woody. And he's got a pretty good pedigree. He's got a pretty good sales record. But, and this is going to speak to a much bigger issue, people make decisions based on what is familiar to them and what is in their worldview. So if we were to go to most of the editors at mainstream comic book companies and we were to say, you know, L.A. Banks died a few years ago, they might say, who?
Right.
If you were to say, have you ever read any work by Stephen Barnes? They would say, who? Octavia Butler, who? Walter Mosley, who?
Gary Phillips.
Yeah, Gary Phillips, who? So those people are quite likely not in their worldview and in their sphere of interest. So when they need to come up with ideas for creators, those people are not going to pop up. And that's part of the problem. And that's why what would really be a good thing is more people of color behind the scenes, more women behind the scenes. And actually, in my fantasies, DC would have a diversity board. DC Comics would have a diversity board of a few people that would say, okay, let's do something here. Like, I'm not saying a mini NAACP because that's too limited, but just a group of different people that can inform you when you're out of step, that can inform you when the material that you're putting out there in no way represents the nation or the world or the zeitgeist of the time. But again, the people in positions of power tend not to be people of color. There are more women that have gotten behind the scenes in the last decade, and that's a great thing.
Yes.
But in terms of people of color, you will find few, if any, in editorial positions where they can influence the hiring of talent. I mean, let's not forget the tweet by Tom Brevoort a few weeks ago where he publicly asked the Twitter community, in terms of, I think, diversity.
Inclusion was the word.
And inclusion. Who do you think is doing it right? And I had a talk with my girlfriend about this. I said, I find it very interesting that a high-ranking editor of the number one comic book company, which is associated with the number one grossing film of 2012, has to ask that question. And my girlfriend said, well, isn't that a damned if you do, damned if you don't? If he doesn't ask the question, you would say, well, why doesn't he ask the question? And when he asks the question, you're like, well, why does he have to ask the question? And I think where I ended it was, information is not hard to find. It's not hard to find out who are the black creators who are out there. Who are the novelists? Who are the artists? It's not hard to discover this information. The black creators, the Latino creators, the Korean creators, the Japanese creators, the Native American creators, the Indian creators, the Somali creators. It's not hard to find this information. So to me, there's a level of surprise when someone has to ask for it. Like, I'll tell you one thing that happened, and then I'm going to, you know, clam up for a minute and probably drink some apple juice. But I was at, Mr. Thomas and I were at the East Coast Black Age of Comics convention last year, and the Friday night before, there was the Glyphs Comics Awards, which was created by Rich Watson to celebrate black characters in comics, or characters of color and creators of color. And I spoke to this guy afterwards, and he was talking all about Ultimate Spider-Man. Oh, Ultimate Spider-Man is so cool. Yeah, I'd buy Ultimate Spider-Man, Miles Morales, this and that, and this and that. And I mentioned to him Dominique Laveau Voodoo Child, which was a Vertigo miniseries that ran 7 issues, was written by Selwyn Seyfu Hines, who's a brother and was, I think, the editor-in-chief of The Source, illustrated by Dennis Cowan, one of the founders of Milestone. Long history. This guy did not know what that comic book was. He did not know about the DC Comics comic book written and illustrated by brothers about a black female hero in New Orleans. But he knew about Ultimate Spider-Man written by someone who is not black or Latino, illustrated by someone who, to my knowledge, if I'm wrong, I apologize, is not black or Latino. And it's interesting how people tout up Miles Morales as this representation of evolution. And Ultimate Spider-Man sells a lot of copies, but I don't see any extra black or Latino characters popping up in the wake of Ultimate Spider-Man. So Ultimate Spider-Man is not the forerunner for a movement. And if we don't go out and educate ourselves to the other books that are out there with creators of color, if we just focus on those things that are within our easy view, then a lot of people who deserve more opportunities and more visibility are never going to get it.
It's absolutely true. I think that was our first episode, wasn't it, Brandon?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, we covered that ground, but yeah. It's always good to hear somebody else who has even greater experience than myself.
Yes,
you know, say the same thing. I mean, this is an issue that one of the things I've always said, and I say this about all social justice, regardless of whether it's gay and lesbian issues or, you know, African American or African diaspora issues. I think everybody knows that there's right and wrong out there, but I don't believe many people care enough to make a difference. Like, I can't believe that anyone at Marvel or DC is sitting there looking at their roster and thinking, yeah, we got enough blacks. You know, I can't believe anyone's thinking that way. What I believe is, on some level, they're quite aware of it, but it's just not an issue. It's not, as you said, their sphere of influence, their circle of influence, or their circle of interest. Therefore, things won't change because there's no incentive for it to change.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, reality, you know.
Things continue as they are, and people buy books and disconnect themselves from the deeper issues that concern them outside of these comic books and the ramifications of their continued purchasing. And so, you know, I have no ill will towards either of those companies. I have friends at DC Comics. There are people at Marvel Comics that I've known for years. And obviously, Marvel and DC Comics represent the fulcrum of the comic book industry. They're needed.
Yes.
But there needs to be more. There needs to be more. And if the two houses, which are the leaders of the industry, cannot provide more, then it is incumbent upon other people to stop asking them to do so and go out there and do it. Like, that's my mantra for 2013. Stop asking. Stop asking. Because at a certain point, it gets pathetic. You know, like, how much do you need to make you realize that asking is futile?
I mean, you know? It's a great, great sentiment. Because, I mean, this is how I'm just looking at all of this stuff these last few weeks. And I really feel that as a black comics consumer, as a black comics creator, it's very disheartening to me. I mean, you think that you get to a point where something is going to happen. I mean, you would hope that something is going to happen. But, I mean, the reality that we're looking at now, there are, unless, you know, changes have been made, unless changes are in the works that we're not aware of, there are no black writers at either Marvel or DC Comics. DC Comics nearly killed off its most prominent black character for reasons unknown. Could be completely valid reasons, but the fact that no one even considered, you know what, maybe it's not a good idea to kill our most prominent black character. I mean, to me, it was the same thing as when they decided that they wanted to introduce Simon Bass.
Right.
You know, hey, that's fine. But do you really, did they really think that releasing some information about this character, he's a suspected terrorist, he's this, he's that, he's on the run, and releasing a picture of him wearing a mask with a Glock. I just couldn't believe that they thought that was the best, you know, first visual representation to give of
Middle
this
Eastern,
new character.
Right. And he's Middle Eastern.
He's Middle Eastern. He might be a terrorist. He's brown skinned. He's wearing a hockey mask. And he's carrying a gun.
Well, I'll do you one better. What it felt like was like the Walking Dead syndrome, where you can't have too many black people on a show at one time.
I mean,
so they had to kill off, you know, every time there's more than two blacks, they kill at least one of them off.
Well, that's what Dwayne McDuffie called the power of three.
Yes.
Which is, once you have three or more black people, it's suddenly black entertainment.
Right.
Yep.
I will be interested to see if, and I'm sorry, this may be Walking Dead spoilers, maybe not. I'll be very interested to see if Michonne, Tyrese, and his sister survive in the season four. I feel like we should start a pool or something.
You know, sister not making it out of season three. Trust me on that.
It's so funny. I have to be honest, like, I'm probably one of the only people on planet Earth that does not watch The Walking Dead. I have my own reasons. But I'll tell you what's interesting about The Walking Dead. And this also, you know, goes to what we're talking about. Michonne is one of the most well-known black characters in comics. And is one of the most well-known black female fictional characters in entertainment, competing with Kerry Washington's character on Scandal. That came from a comic book created by a white man. And I kind of find that there's this interesting thing that happens in comics. And I thought the same thing back when Alan Moore created Tom Strong. And Tom Strong, you know, has a black wife, and I forget her name, but the daughter's name is Tesla Strong, after Nikola Tesla. Mm-hmm. And I was like, huh, white writers are given license to create black characters. But black creators, the few that there are, no such.
Well, we're expected to create black characters. Otherwise, why are we creating comics at all?
Right. And that's, and you know, that's why it was so great that, you know, Molly Danger is white. And I have no problem with that, because the whole thing is, the important thing is that Molly Danger is a hero.
Right.
You know, that's the important thing. Molly Danger doesn't have to be black. And we know Jamal Igel, so we can expect Jamal Igel's worldview to come into play with his fiction. But it's like you said, that's expected, it doesn't have to be. But again, it's very interesting that a character that popular had to be created by Robert Kirkman, because other people would not have been given the opportunity to do such.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
one of the things that I've found over the years is that with black creators, particularly in the comic book, in the comic book world, the mainstream white readership seems to believe that all black creators do is come up with anti-white plots and anti-white characters. Like, everything we do is to be created in opposition to whiteness. You know what I mean? It's just like when I talk to people and I'm like, oh, I have a black character, I got a Latino character, and I tell them like plots, they're like, oh, okay, so this isn't political. And I'm like, well, not inherently, no, because I'm just telling a really fun story, any more than Star Wars was political. It's just a really fun story, technically speaking. And they're just like, oh, okay, well, that sounds cool. And I'm like, well, what did you think? It was going to be like Kill Whitey the series? I mean, it just feels like everyone believes we're one-dimensional. And that's the problem. Like, no matter how diverse we are as a people, we're still generally considered to be a combination of Malcolm X and Lil Wayne. You know, like, that's what people think all black men are.
Oh,
man, that hurts. Oh, man, because Malcolm X is one of my heroes, man.
No, there's nothing wrong with Malcolm X. But what my point is to say that when people think of Malcolm X, they do not have any idea about his complexity. People tend to think of Malcolm X in an extremely one-dimensional, hiding behind the window shade with a machine gun in his hand.
That's right.
That's the white, it's not even white. It's just like a mainstream identification of Malcolm X. I mean, even some black people think of Malcolm X that way and know nothing about his post-Mecca conversion.
Exactly.
So when I say that, I'm not saying it is a negative or pejorative term toward Malcolm X. I'm saying that the one-dimensional idea of what black creators can be is based on Lil Wayne, who is, in my mind, extremely one-dimensional or zero-dimensional, and then the one-dimensional thought of what Malcolm X is or was. You know what
right.
I mean? Like,
yeah.
Everyone thinks we're these, like, trigger-happy, Nation of Islam-loving gun thugs who, if we do have enough sense to write, everything we write is going to be bile toward white supremacy.
It's angry. Which,
yeah, everything we, our whole existence, if we're coherent enough to learn how to write sentences, is all it's going to be is prison letters. Like, I think that, no, I'm dead serious. I really believe, and it's not everybody, but I really get this feeling that a lot of particularly white comic book readers and a lot of black comic book readers think that all black creators are basically one step above, like, prison letter writers in comic book format. Like, they all think we're going to be telling these really dark, depressing, like, comic book versions of The Wire, but with less depth.
That was good. That was good. Yeah. That's an astute observation, and I cannot disagree with it. And I mean, the only way to remove that is to get work out there no matter what and prove otherwise. I mean, that's the only way that you can challenge ignorance or a lack of understanding, is to challenge it with good material that disputes it.
Right.
You know, that's where it has to happen. So, you know, again, my thing is stop asking and create it. Create it and make it good. Don't just create it, make it good. Mm-hmm. If it's not as good as those things that you love, it should probably wait until you can make it as good as something you love, and then get it out there. Unless you desperately, it's this story that you're dying to get it out there. Get it out there. But the most important thing is that creators work together, create good stories, and get those stories out to the public and tell their stories. Create the kinds of heroes that they want to see instead of asking for others to give them those heroes.
And then you also don't have to worry about some company coming in and deciding that your hero is, you know, over and now they're going to either kill them or give them to someone else to write.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, one thing that's interesting this year with these things happening this year is this year is the 20th anniversary of Milestone.
Yeah.
And there is an irony of so many things happening with the absence of black creators or things happening to black characters on the 20th anniversary of the launching of a comic book universe founded by black men who created such diversity, and the fact that that is remembered 20 years later, and the tragedy that the company that has the power to bring these characters back to light in full force chooses not to do so for whatever reason. And I think that was really what made me come up with stop asking. I think because there were so many people that were doing that, they were like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? It's like, nothing's going to happen. Nothing. That is what is going to happen. Nothing. There is your answer. Now, what will you do with that answer? In the face of that answer, what are you going to do? That's it.
Wow. And there we go.
Man, that's that.
That's that.
Well, yep.
Well, I think that's a great point to end on. I'd like to thank you, Joe, for coming by and dropping some knowledge on the two Brandons.
Nope, gentlemen, thanks for having me, and I admire you both because you guys are out there getting the material out against all odds, and you're creating all heroes, and you're actually putting your money where your mouth is, and hopefully you will inspire others to do the same.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Hopefully.
I'm just all right.
Trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, people got to buy it first.
You have to buy it.
You got to buy it.
It's true. That was the line in the first episode. That's it.
You have to buy it.
You have to buy it. So keep the fight up, gentlemen.
All right.
Oh, well, you too, brother. I mean, I have to say it was a pleasure meeting you like last year in New York City for the first time after we all knowing the same people for like a decade.
Yeah, dude, that was great to like meet you face to face and just like, I mean, I just love your candor. You're to the point where it scares me sometimes. It's like, wow, this dude is the man without fear. Like, this is Daredevil. Like, he has no fear, and I love it, and I admire it.
Well,
so,
thank you very much, man. I appreciate that.
All right, so thank you for having me, guys.
All right, thank you for coming by.
All right, take care.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
All right.